Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. And welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobas, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Ian McGregor about his history of the most famous hotspot of the Cold War, entitled Checkpoint Charlie, the Cold War, the Berlin Wall, and the Most Dangerous Place on Earth. Ian, welcome to New Books Network.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for agreeing to be on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Well, I live in London. I've been a publisher in the UK publishing trade for nearly 30 years. I've always worked in editorial. My degree was in modern European history. So I've always worked in nonfiction. And my specialty that I've developed over the last 17, 18 years or so of actually commissioning titles. So obviously you work your way up from being a desk editor to a commissioning editor to then a publisher, which is what I am now. I've predominantly published history books. I've published everything from ancient Roman history to the Vikings to Napoleonic, to even American Civil War, which I've published books on several battles in the American Civil War, obviously Gettysburg, Chancellorsville, that kind of thing. But I specialize mainly, and what I like to work on is oral history, because that to me is the most important type of history you can publish, because then you're getting it from the actual source, you're getting it from the well, so to speak. So I've published many books in oral history that have been bestsellers, where obviously I publish books that are relevant to the Great War, the Second World War, the Vietnam War, etc. So that's what led me to deciding. It's a natural progression. That's what led me to deciding if I could write at all. I didn't want to go into fiction. I'd be completely useless. I wanted to go into nonfiction. And obviously, if I was going to do nonfiction, I wanted to write a history book.
And I was thinking that when you were just mentioning about how the value you accord to oral history, how that really shows through in your book, is that yours is not just a straightforward, the wall went up on this date and on this date these people cross. You capture their stories. And I thought it was especially fascinating how you capture stories of people whose lives were intertwined with the history of the wall throughout its history. And I thought that was especially fascinating.
Well, that was the core idea I had. I mean, basically, a lot of the work I do as a publisher is I'll obviously buy books from literary agents and get into what is euphemistically called an auction for a book with other publishers. But also, I'm known in the book trade for coming up with my own ideas, especially in history books, for things that I would like to read and that aren't in the bookshops yet. So, and I'll go out and source my own author and I'll develop the project. So the Berlin Wall was one of those such projects. I because I have a love for it anyway, and I have a fascination with Eastern European history after the Second World War. As a segue, I was very lucky when I was a teenager. My parents sent me on a student exchange to Leningrad in 1981. So it was amazing to see what Soviet Russia was like then. And that always kind of imbued me with an enthusiasm for East European history. My degree, my dissertation to end my degree was on the Prague Spring of 1968. So with this, I was thinking, I knew that the anniversary was coming up to the 30th anniversary in 2019, and this is all of 3 years ago. And I started thinking I want to publish a book on the Berlin Wall, but I want to do it, as I just said, through the prism of oral history. So I just started talking to people, and I did some investigation about who would be available to talk to. And within a few months, the more I started talking to people and the more exciting it became, because you listen to their amazing anecdotes of their service or their experiences if they were civilians, I just got the bug. And I just thought, I've recorded at least a dozen interviews here, and it's just incredible. Just to donate these to an archive would be incredible. And I thought, I want to do it justice, so I want to write it.
So I was wondering if you could perhaps start us off by talking a bit about the context. We hear a lot about the Berlin Wall. We see the images of it both going up and coming down are very iconic. Could you perhaps explain why there was a wall and what its purpose was, or what the intention was, and why was it viewed by the people who constructed it as necessary at that time?
Sure. Well, fundamentally, it was a wall to keep people in, not to keep people out. So the potted history is basically the end of the Second World War. The Russians, as obviously under Joseph Stalin, advanced well into Central Europe. They almost split Germany in two. They were occupying parts of Austria, Hungary, obviously Poland, Czechoslovakia, all the way along. And that was the famous speech that Churchill gave after the Second World War in Fulton, Missouri, where he said, "An iron curtain is stretching across Central Europe." And that indeed is what it was. But obviously, even though Stalin had put in these puppet regimes in these satellite countries to obviously give Russia a buffer zone of protection from any future invasion from the West, people still, especially if they were close to the West European border, had the potential to escape and seek a new life in the Western democracies as they saw it. So once the Marshall Plan after 1947-48 was well underway, with America pumping billions of dollars into the rebuilding and restructuring of Europe, it became a game of chess. And it was, how can the East European bloc match what the West had to offer? But equally, if that wasn't working, how could they stop their own populations moving and vacating the countries that they were living in at the time? And the key focus there was obviously Germany. East Germany was now a sovereign state under Walter Ulbricht. Obviously, his masters were in Moscow. But the kind of economy and the kind of society he was trying to build, a utopian socialist society in his eyes, but a very communist-ridden arbitrary and quite vicious regime too, with not much commercial consumer products available, very long working hours for the population, a fast-moving industrial complex that was trying to catch up with the West, where workers had to work very, very arduous long hours for little pay. So it was obvious that the population of Eastern Europe and the population of East Germany in particular thought, we don't want to have this kind of life. We want something better. So they were voting with their feet. The East Germany was losing tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands of its own citizens that were migrating to the West. And they migrated through the loophole that was Berlin. So after the Second World War, Berlin was split into four sectors, as Germany itself had been. There was a French, there was a British, there was an American, obviously there was a Soviet sector. The Soviet sector was run by the GDR, the Socialist State of East Germany. But there was no real barriers. There was obviously checkpoints where people could come and go. But in a city of 2.3 million people, as you see in any city in America or in Britain or in Europe now, people crisscross cities to go to work, to visit families, to do lots of things. And this was the case before a war was needed to keep people in, because what the East German state was finding was people might be saying, I'm just going over to West Berlin to go and visit someone, or I might be going on a day trip, or it might be my job, but they weren't coming back. And before you know it, the main section of East German society, the professional classes, the age group of 25 to 40 year olds that were the lifeblood of any economy, were leaving the country via this loophole in Berlin. They would go through the checkpoints quite easily, whether by train, on foot, in car, and they wouldn't come back. And they'd end up in a refugee resettlement center before they were shipped out to West Germany and resettled. And so over 2 million citizens had left East Germany by the time Walter Ulbricht and his henchmen, so to speak, Erich Honecker, who would later become leader in the 1970s, decided something has to be done. In the geopolitical picture, obviously, Nikita Khrushchev was in charge of the Soviet Union. He was going head to head with your young, vibrant President John F. Kennedy in the early 1960s. And Berlin was the burning question. A lot of people get distracted with the Cuban Missile Crisis, but Berlin was always, always the main issue of dispute between the Soviet Union and the Americans because of the drain of human resources going from East Germany into the West.
One of the points you make in the book, which I must confess, I never really fully appreciated until you made it, which was how the issue developed over time. I was particularly struck by how you pointed out initially when you start to see the beginnings of this exodus in the early 50s, mm-hmm. how people like Stalin actually thought it was a good thing that here are all the dissenters and troublemakers that are going away. The analogy I had in my mind was how Castro sometimes used things like the Mariel boat lift to get rid of all the people that he didn't want in his socialist paradise. Now, initially, they didn't have a problem with it, which would explain why you don't have a Berlin Wall in, say, 53 or 55. But by 1961, it's no longer just a matter of a few troublemakers. You're talking about, you know, really the best and the brightest in German society.
Well, that was the problem. It's fine for Stalin to think that at the time, but that was the early 50s. It wasn't the issue it would become by 1961. By, like I was saying, by 1961, it was hundreds of thousands of workers, potential workers for the East German economy. And as a kind of inverse domino theory, I know the Americans had the domino theory of Southeast Asia. To the Soviet leadership, it might be a problem for the buffer states that surrounded them, that was facing out to the West. If the East German economy collapsed because of a lack of a workforce, that might have a knock-on effect to Poland, to Hungary, to Czechoslovakia. So Walter Ulbricht was constantly pressurizing the Soviet leadership to help him and do something. There'd been an East German uprising through complaints against the regime in 1953, which had been brutally put down with Russian tanks. But that couldn't really happen by the time of 1961 because the stakes had got bigger. JFK and Khrushchev had already had their summit in Vienna that summer of 61, where they'd seriously gone head to head. And people knew that a Cold War really, really was now freezing cold, with Berlin the main issue. So the world's eyes were on the city, so it was a lot harder to just be to have a brutal crackdown to stop this kind of migration. They had to think something a little bit more sophisticated. Even though we might think building a wall is barbaric, it was a lot better than shooting people.
I remember that was Kennedy's phrase, a wall is a hell of a lot better than a war.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I say in the book, is the fact that I'm sure this will come out in years to come. I found some material in the archives that there's plenty of eyewitness accounts for, you would think, any half decent intelligence officer to realize something big was going on in around and in East Berlin before the wall went up, with the amount of materiel and men and machinery that was suddenly being stockpiled around and inside the city to obviously build this thing. Plenty of agencies, plenty of personnel, plenty of eyewitness accounts from East Germans that were coming through the checkpoints to still migrate right up until the night before the wall was built, were all saying something's going on over there. But for whatever reason, no one put two and two together to think they are actually going to build a huge barrier.
I was wondering if you could take us to that night in August of 1961, which I thought you captured very evocatively, the sense of how there was this tension, with the added idea being that it wasn't just a matter of they didn't know what was going to happen. It was the concern that what was going to happen was going to be a military incursion, some sort of takeover of West Berlin, and maybe even World War III. What was going on in the lives of some of the people that you talk about that were there that night?
Yeah, well, I it was important to me to try and capture ordinary people's experiences throughout the book. So I wanted to avoid, and it's what I say in the introduction, it's not a book about geopolitics or a grand strategy with just the big names of history that are involved. Obviously, they're in my book because, you have to name check them. But what I wanted to record were ordinary people's experiences on both sides of the wall, I might add, of what life was like. And obviously, as you just said, I wanted to capture what it was for the people who found themselves, for want of a better phrase, entombed in Berlin over that weekend of the 13th of August, 1961. So very careful. I've got a very bad voice, but it was very carefully planned. The East German state knew what they were doing. They deliberately picked a weekend where they knew in the middle of August that the Berlin population would be seeking to get away from the hot weather, to get out to the lakes, because Berlin's surrounded by some absolutely beautiful lakes and parks. So everyone would be distracted by just trying to have a relaxing time. Doesn't matter whether you're on the east or the west side of the city. So it would have been at its quietest. There would have been less people around. Lots of people would have been away on business. Lots of people would have been away that were serving in the military personnel in the west too. So it was a lot easier to move around the city, and that's why they chose it. So it took everyone by surprise. Like I said, I mean, maybe if you joined the dots, you could think something's going to happen. But on the front line, whether you're an American military policeman stationed at Checkpoint Charlie, whether you're a newspaper man, or whether you're working for the American radio station, or whether you're just, you could be even a milkman driving across the border, everyone was taken by surprise. Everyone was fearful. Everyone was paranoid. What's this leading to? Because it's, at the end of the day, Berlin and the hinterland of Berlin was surrounded by tens of thousands of Soviet troops. It was surrounded by well-armed units of East German militia and factory fighting workers. This was a frontline city. It was an exciting city to live in. And obviously, if you lived in West Berlin, it was a very colorful and dramatic place to be. A city of spies, as if you read any of the John le Carré or Len Dayton novels. But it was still quite a scary place. And it's the obvious thing to think. You think, why are all these troops suddenly moving around? Why have all these huge arc lights suddenly been turned on around the iconic sites like the Reichstag, the Brandenburg Gate? Why are all these drills happening? Why has all this barbed wire suddenly been strung up? And more importantly, why have people's movements suddenly been abruptly stopped? Forcibly and very aggressively, not towards the Allies, I might add, but always towards the East Germans.
You mentioned that about how that's one of the things I really enjoyed about those chapters where you're describing the erection of the wall, which is how you quote the some of the you follow some of the MPs, the British and American military police. And some of the civilians who are trying to take stock of the situation, they're seeing all this military activity, and they have to be very careful. Is this happening within their border? Is this an incursion? How do you handle something like this? And as you explain, even if it had been an incursion, the military police, the military detachments that were stationed in West Berlin by the British and the Americans and the French were in no real condition to do more than delay any sort of attack. So, I mean, it was you capture how frightening this was for all of them to suddenly experience this burst of activity after this period of growing tension.
Yes, I mean, well, there were very well armed, well supported military units for the Allies in West Berlin, but there were never more than 10,000 or so troops. And that would, having talked to the experts, so obviously, as you said, I mean, I interviewed plenty of people from commandants of the actual Allied sectors all the way down to private first class. And they all said the same thing. They would have put up a hell of a fight, but you'd literally only be talking about 3, maybe 5 to 6 days, if you were lucky, street fighting before it was all over. Because just as you've seen in many World War II engagements, say, for instance, Operation Market Garden, lightly armed troops who might have anti-tank weapons and heavy machine guns are no match for tanks and motorized vehicles and fighter jets flying over you, probably laying carpets of bombs. They wouldn't have lasted that long. And as I say in later on in the book, when I'm interviewing Major General Robert Corbett, who was the British commandant in 1989, he was quite honest with me and said, we would have been goners. I mean, they were his words. He said, but we would have put up a bloody good show. And that that kind of feeling resonates all the way through right to the beginning of the war. So there were the same number of troops, but the Allies had a handful of tanks, they had a handful of armored vehicles, and then it was mainly military police, French, British, and American, that were manning all the sectors. So as long as I would say, as long as they could see that what the massed ranks of East German militias and troops and police were doing was inside the sovereign territory of East Germany itself and East Berlin itself, and they realized that they weren't encroaching on their own sectors, so therefore no danger was going to come to them. That's why there was no response from the Allies in the first few days of after the 13th of August, because they knew, well, nothing's coming into our sector. They're literally doing this to their own people. So it would have been, I would imagine, and as I describe it, it was very frightening. It was probably more frightening for the civilians because they wouldn't have had any idea what was going on. Whereas for the military, I think within about 48 to 72 hours, they had a very, very good idea that the Western sector was intact. The Western sector was safe. It was primarily to seal off the Soviet sector. That was what Operation Rose, which is what it was called, was all about.
Let's talk a bit about the civilian response, because you describe you've interviewed some civilians in Berlin who were in Berlin at the time, and you relate some of their stories about how they're reacting to this sudden change of situation, to where there is at the very least the possibility of a fairly easy escape from the East, to suddenly these barriers are going up and all of a sudden it changes the situation. How do they respond? Not just in East Berlin among the Eastern Germans, but also in West Berlin among the Germans there.
Well, I mean, it's like I was saying, it's one of shock, terror, and fear as to not just what's going to happen in the near future, I suppose, but if you have loved ones, which is what I describe in the book, trapped on the eastern side, just through being in the wrong place at the wrong time, that was what I wanted to try and capture. So one of the main interviewees I talked to, who actually lives in West London now, and that's where I interviewed her, is Margit Hosseini, and she's now 83, but some of the things she saw from, say, the late 50s all the way through to the mid 60s were incredible. And she really witnessed iconic moments in Cold War history. So she'd moved back to West Berlin with her father, who was a diplomat, after the Second World War and after it had died, the tension had died down after the uprising of 1953, which I just said the Russians had brutally suppressed. So she was a young schoolgirl. She was probably about 14, 15, towards the end of the 50s, and she was seeing what the city was like. So I was trying to capture through her eyes of what it was like for someone who was used to the luxuries that being in the professional class of a West Berlin household compared to going to visit your relatives in East Berlin was like. So she was talking about walking through rubble-torn streets with bullet holes still on the walls, shrapnel scars everywhere, and houses in complete disrepair because obviously the Russians were focusing more on stripping the East German economy to ship it back to Russia for reparations rather than rebuilding their sector of the city, which is obviously what the Allies were busy doing. They were rebuilding the city. So I tried to capture that through her eyes. And then as time goes on and the day of the wall being built, her interview was essential because she definitely captured the confusion and terror through a teenager's eyes because through happen chance, her sister, her younger sister, who she adored, had been staying with her grandmother who lived in the northeastern side of Berlin and was a committed communist, a committed socialist, and wanted to stay and help rebuild that society. So, but because I was saying before, it was easy to go through the checkpoints. Marguerite's family constantly traveled through to East Berlin to deliver gifts and see loved ones and catch up with their news and that kind of thing, and have long debates into the night, she used to say, about politics and why that side of the family wanted to stay in East Berlin. So her sister's trapped for all she knows and her concerned mother and father know, along with hundreds of other, or thousands even, of other West Berliners. They're thinking, what's happened to our loved ones on the other side of the border? And they're refusing us entry to come through. And so they spent nearly a day running around the city, trying to find out where she was she safe, how would they get her back, until they eventually did a few days later. But that was just one civilian on the western side's experience. On the eastern side, what I wanted to capture was two or three East German teenagers who were belonging to families that were committed to the socialist dream, who wanted to stay there and build the state. So Stefan Voller, who I talked about, his father was an expert economist who was part of the East German Politburo, who were governing where the East German economy was going to go in the 1960s. And he was on a boys' camp with the youth movement of the SED, the socialist movement that governed the GDR. And I tried to capture his viewpoint. And as far as he was concerned, he swallowed the government line, as pretty much everyone else did on the other side, hook, line, and sinker. It was an anti-fascist barrier that was going to protect the East German from growing successfully, from not being interfered with by the malign interference of Western intelligence agencies, Western influence of decadence that capitalism brought. And again, so I try to get a yin and a yang of what the wall meant to both sides of the equation. And I try to do that throughout the book. So I just try to capture that at the beginning.
It's interesting to see how the Berliners come to accept the wall. You describe early on how, as it's going up, some Berliners, some in the East do their best to take advantage of last moment escapes. You describe how the Berlin Fire Brigade is being called out to, protect jumpers until the border guards break up the walls. But you also describe how, as time goes along, the wall becomes a fact of life, and how it becomes a part of the existence of Berlin. I was wondering if you could perhaps describe some of that, both in terms of the civilians in Berlin, but also as well the military, how it becomes even more so in some ways a front line in the Cold War.
Yeah, well, with the civilians, were obviously, I mean, it was shocking, and it took a good 2 to 3 years for the civilians in West Berlin to accept it as the norm, to accept that it wasn't going to go away. And obviously they were watching brick by brick, almost. It's a cliche, but it's true. But watching their half of the city being separated from East Berlin by a more complex barrier. Because obviously when the barrier went up for the first time, on August 13th, and then for the next few days and the next few weeks, it was pretty much a barbed wire construction, because that's what they had. And then that was almost a toe in the water, you could say. They were testing to see if there would be an Allied reaction. And within a couple of days when they knew that wasn't coming and the Allies weren't going to knock it down, that's when the second phase came in, and they arbitrarily and quickly started building, you know, very very hastily built walls. And if you look at a lot of the pictures of the heartache that you see of separation of families who are standing on tables and chairs, looking over the wall that's just hastily been built, they're mainly breeze blocks. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people don't know that why construction of East Berlin housing for the local population was put back for quite a long time, several years, you could argue, because a lot of the materials that have been stockpiled and ordered to build new flats and new shops and new buildings was actually purloined by Operation Rose to actually build the wall. So that happened, and it gradually, the all-consuming suffocation of East Berlin was gradual over months. And that's, again, you mentioned it, that's why you see, as each sector right by the border was sealed off, human beings being what they are, they find ingenious ways of, well, if I can't get out this way, maybe we can get out that way. And that's why I interview and talk about various ingenious escapes people had, whether through the sewers, through going through derelict and abandoned buildings right by the border that the police had checked but just assumed no one else would get through, how tunnels were built and constructed to get people out. And it was almost a cat and mouse game that the authorities were playing with their own population to prevent them escaping. And so you mentioned it. That's why you have that famous scene of Frieda Schultz, 77-year-old pensioner, who is the one dangling from a first-story apartment block because her window overlooked the French sector. And as she's wondering whether she can jump down to the waiting crowd, the East German police burst into her house to try and prevent her getting out. So you have the ludicrous scene, which makes a great iconic picture of she's dangling by the arms of an East German policeman who's trying to pull her back through the window, whereas 15 feet below her, the waiting crowd and the firemen with the tarpaulin spread out are waiting for her to jump down. And in the end, two people had to climb up a window frame to grab onto her ankles so their weight would pull her down and she escaped. And that captured the ludicrousness of the situation, where obviously it was a grand plan, Operation Rose, and they knew what they were going to do step by step. But you can never plan for what human beings or how human beings will react to being enclosed, and that the hardcore ones who want to escape will try and do anything to escape. And I tried to capture that in the book. As far as the military are concerned, I think that, all the people I talked to, especially the American troops and the military policemen I talked to, were of the same opinion. They were very shocked. They were very angry. They were resentful at first of why their superiors weren't trying to react and break down the barriers. I mentioned one of the key interviews is Lieutenant Werner Pike, who was a military police lieutenant at Checkpoint Charlie. He watched as the barriers went up, and he said to me with a wry smile that, you know, as we were watching these East German militias building their barriers 2 or 3 days after the main one went up, they would be shouting across to the Americans saying, you do know we have no bullets in our guns. Now's your chance. If you want to do something, do something. But that was obviously being passed back up the chain, but nothing was done because obviously, as you said earlier, referred to earlier, there was a grander plan, and JFK and his administration were thinking, well, a wall is better than having a war. So as long as it didn't affect the Allies, they were prepared to maybe, it's a strong thing to say, but sacrifice the East Berliners and have them surrounded and their freedoms curtailed. So there was a balance, and the British and the French were the same. They were trying their best to facilitate and help any escapees if they could try and get through the barbed wire and then over the first version of the wall. But obviously, as soon as the civilians and the Allies saw what the East German border guards and the authorities were prepared to do, i.e. shoot to kill, and they were doing that within the first week the wall going up, then it became a whole different ball game, and they knew that this was more deadly serious. And then obviously, as time went by, within a year, you're talking about, and what I describe in the book is, it becomes a bigger game of, can the East Germans and the Russians squeeze more concessions out of the Allies and perhaps pressurize and force them to give up more rights that they've got in West Berlin that had been agreed? So rights of travel, freedom of travel into East Berlin, which wasn't stopped when the Berlin Wall went up. But by October of the following year, that's exactly what they were scheming to do, in the fact that they started to demand seeing identification of either foreign diplomats crossing from west to east, when that went straight against what the four power agreement had been, that if you're driving vehicles with foreign diplomatic plates, you weren't stopped, you were obviously waved through, your vehicle wasn't checked, you had immunity. Whereas what happened in October 1962 was the famous tank standoff, where an American diplomat was taking his wife to the theater, to the opera in East Berlin, because East Berlin was still famous for having some of the best opera in the world that was dirt cheap to go and watch, and to go and have a lovely meal that was very cheap too, because of the difference in the East German and the West German and the American currency. And because he was stopped at the Checkpoint Charlie to have his ID checked, one thing led to another. And before you know it, you have half a dozen Soviet tanks facing off 100 yards away, half a dozen American M40 tanks locked and loaded, and within a hair's breadth of starting World War III. And obviously, that's where the big players become involved, and it went in the Soviet Union, it went right up to Nikita Khrushchev, and in the White House it went right up to JFK to try and resolve the issue and to have it back down. And that's how it could be argued, and that's why I put it on the front cover of the subtitle of the book, it became the most dangerous place on earth, because it was an open sore in the Cold War. By the 1960s, you obviously had the Korean War had finished, and there was the demarcation line of North and South Korea and the demilitarized zone, but they weren't at war anymore. The Vietnam War had yet to really kick off. So right then and there, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, you had Berlin, and Berlin was the one place where armed troops were facing each other and potentially could do battle over the most spurious of thing, like asking a diplomat to show him some ID.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You recount as well a lot of the stories of escape that take place over the next 25 years. I was wondering, is there one in particular that's a favorite of yours, or one that really stood out for you as you were hearing about it, or as you were recounting it in your book?
I think that, yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk about it because I just thought it summed up the futility of the Berlin Wall, and it also summed up for me the tragedy of what the Cold War had done to the East German population. And that's chapter 17 in the book. It's called The Last Escape. And it's basically the last East Germans to escape through Checkpoint Charlie. There were a couple of more escapes through the actual inter-German border outside of Berlin, but through the actual iconic section of that part of the Berlin Wall was Hans-Peter Spitzner and his daughter, Peggy. And it was just such a lovely story. So that, and it summed up how the bankruptcy by the late 80s of the East German state and what it couldn't offer its population. And because it couldn't offer the just the basics we take for granted in the West of consumer goods, a lack of interference in your everyday life, a choice of what career you wanted to have, more importantly, a choice of what political persuasion you want to be. And ultimately, which was the trigger of the wall coming down, free travel, freedom to decide where you want to go. And because the bankruptcy of all of that happened, by the time of Peter Spitzner in 1989, he was typical of many East Germans, hundreds of thousands of East Germans. He'd had enough of the state. He knew that it was no life for him, and particularly now he had a child, it was no life for her, and he wanted to get out. He'd already been picked up by the Stasi and interrogated heavily and quite scarily just because of expressing a different political opinion at a workers' community election process. He just had said, I don't really want to vote for any of these candidates because they've just been put up in front of me. I have no choice who I want. And because he'd expressed that, he had a black mark against his name. He was picked up very quickly and underwent 24 hours extensive interrogation. And so he wanted to get out. And he was lucky that because his wife was visiting relatives in Austria and she'd been let out of the country because the authorities knew they had hostages, i.e. they had Peter and his daughter still in East Germany, she would come back. And so he took the choice of, well, this is the time that we need to go. And he took a very, very desperate and very simplistic attack of how he would get through. And it was to take his daughter, who was 9 at the time, down to Berlin, where he'd been on various trips as a student. So he didn't really know his way around Berlin. And with the money he had on him, the money he took with him, he managed to have food and drink for the next 2 to 3 weeks, befriended a pastor who hid and sheltered them while they were trying their best to stay hidden in East Berlin. And they simply went down to Checkpoint Charlie to try and persuade either a diplomat or a tourist or allied military personnel who were traveling through in their vehicles who wouldn't be checked, obviously, to hide them and get them through the Byzantine checks that the East Germans had in place by then. And as a side note, that's the thing I talk about in the book. On the Allied side, Checkpoint Charlie was always ever just a simplistic hut. It got slightly bigger as time went on, but it was always ever just a very simplistic hut, a mobile hut that represented to the Allies what they thought of the separation of Berlin, as in they didn't particularly recognize it. They were showing to the East Germans that the hut itself could be taken away in a moment's notice, click of the fingers, because then the city would be whole again. And they were ready for that moment. Whereas on the East German side, it was a huge complex, much like something that maybe your President Donald Trump would like on the border to Mexico. It was really purpose built with the latest technology, cost millions of dollars to build, to really find and stop anyone trying to get through. And by the late 80s, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of tourists and diplomats and allied personnel were daily traveling through this checkpoint, bringing much needed currency to the East German state. So here's Peter with his daughter. He's down there and he's seeing countless coach trips coming through. He's seeing countless diplomatic cars coming through. And obviously he's seeing dozens and dozens and dozens of military vehicles coming through, begging them to, you know, he'd be approaching them down side streets away from Checkpoint Charlie, saying, you know, will you take me and my daughter? We're desperate to leave. And no one would. And then just literally, I think he'd given himself another 24 hours before he was going to give up and get back home. He managed to come across an American army private, Eric Yore, and who basically just took pity on them. And in a you know, in a moment, you might say a moment of madness, because it was a very dangerous thing to do, but in a very humanitarian gesture, said, "Yep, I'll do it." And he put Peggy and Peter in the boot of his car and slowly made his way to Checkpoint Charlie, and then made his way through the checkpoints, and then obviously drove straight through to an Allied control, to where he opened the boot up and in a very emotional moment, which I try my best to capture, said, takes Peter and Peggy, who are blinking in the sunlight, who've been trapped in this boot for hours, out and into the compound, and says, "Welcome to freedom." And what I tried to also capture was not just the shock of how do they get used to a new life in the West, but equally a month or so later, the shock of them having been rehoused and relocated in West Germany, seeing the Berlin Wall fall down. And I remember, and you might remember, when I was a student at university, I was watching the TV, my mouth was to the floor, because to my generation, the Berlin Wall was like the Himalayas. It was so permanent. It was such a fixture in our lives. You just never assumed it would ever come down, ever. And for someone living in East Germany who'd grown up with it and been so indoctrinated by the system and so cowed by the system, and then to have the bravery to escape it, and then to watch it come down and see his countrymen flood through, it must have been such an emotional moment. And I tried to capture that in the book too. And it's an amazing story. And there's lots of escapes I talk about. And you mentioned it. I talk about people driving through. I talk about people climbing over the wall. I talk about people tunneling, which is an exceptional story as well. But just from a human story, and it's right at the end as well, so it captures it perfectly, of how this was a man who was going to risk everything, including his life, to escape, not knowing that, you know, in a very, very short space of time, he was watching hundreds of thousands of his countrymen do exactly the same thing, but with no fear of repression, no fear of being killed, because the wall had now fallen. And I just thought it was a perfect ending to that chapter in the book.
I like that point that you're making, which is just we talk about how iconic the fall of the Berlin Wall is. And it's something that sometimes we can overlook in retrospect, which was how unexpected it was. It was in its own way as unexpected as the construction of the wall on August 13th. I was wondering if you could perhaps finish this off by talking a bit about that experience for a lot of the people involved. You mentioned how the commander of British forces in Berlin was there, and how you interview all these other individuals who were there, who, you know, even though you were seeing Gorbachev introducing Glasnost, and you were seeing, you know, the this growing anticipation that the Cold War was winding down, how the idea, as you just mentioned, of this, you know, seemingly permanent barrier. Basically, you're going away in a matter of hours, practically.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. I mean, one of the things Major General Corbett said to me was, and it's in the book, where once he'd accepted to do the job, he was interviewed by the British Foreign Secretary at the time, who said to him, and he'd asked, he'd obviously asked the question, well, is there any chance while I'm there that the wall will come down? Because obviously he was just about to accept the position. And, you know, within in a very short space of time, the wall would come down in his first year in the job. But obviously from 85 onwards, as you just said, Mikhail Gorbachev was bringing in his liberalization of the Soviet Union, but also without the West fully knowing, he was obviously dismantling the very close economic and military ties that the Soviet Union or Russia itself had to the satellite states that Stalin and then Khrushchev had set up and supported all through the Cold War. And by dismantling, what I mean is the tap was being switched off with how much economic military aid that these countries were going to get. Obviously, the Allies and civilian populations like ourselves living in America, Britain, France, Germany, West Germany, sorry, etc. We didn't know this at the time. All we saw was these high-powered speeches and conferences that Ronald Reagan was having with Gorbachev about arms control. Arms control was on a different plane to everything else that were going on. Everyone was focusing on all these short-range intercontinental missiles be removed from Europe? Because what Europe, and I remember this because I was studying in high school and I was studying for my degree at the time, we were petrified. We'd been brought up all the time through TV and in our school books, in our lessons at school, that, you know, annihilation, nuclear annihilation was minutes away. And so to have all these missiles based around Europe and in Britain especially was a huge thing. So everyone was focusing on that. No one was really focusing on, well, what's going on with the relationship between the eastern states? How will that go? And obviously all we saw at face value was a very, very strong, very dynamic and very what seemed like a successful East German state, a successful Czechoslovakian state. They were very firmly in control. Obviously, from about 86, 87 onwards, there were really big situations going on in Poland with the rise of Solidarity. And that's where you could argue the fall of the Eastern Bloc really began. That's where the first chink in the armor happened. But it was primarily through Gorbachev. So back to Robert Corbett, he's asking Sir Geoffrey Howe, the foreign secretary, is there any chance while I'm there that Berlin Wall will come down? And Howe famously said to him, the Berlin Wall won't come down in our lifetime. And that's someone who's the foreign secretary who sees daily briefings from all the intelligence agencies that are situated in Berlin and along the border. He had firsthand accounts and he's using his specialist knowledge to say that. So that goes to show that everyone was taken by surprise. But what I liked about Robert was, as he says in the book, he was a real people person, and he spoke fluent German, and he'd been in Germany at the start of proceedings when the Berlin Wall went up. So the prologue of my book talks about him as a young lieutenant who's guarding a vital supply train going from West Germany into West Berlin after the wall had been built, and all the problems he had getting that in. And here we have the stories turned full circle, and now he's in charge of the British sector in 1989. And he said he wanted to make a point of getting to know the East Berlin people to see what life really was like, because obviously he's getting all these reports from his intelligence services that are out there that are allowed to go into East Germany and East Berlin, but he wanted to see it for himself. And he was seeing it firsthand. He actually had an inkling the pressure cooker's really bubbling here. These people want change. They're desperate for change. They want us to help. And I would think probably it was the Gorbachev visit in late 89 that really sealed the fate. So obviously they'd had a whole summer in 89 of the issue which I raised before about Peter Spitzner of free travel to East Germans. That was a fundamental issue. For a whole new generation of East Germans that were now in their 20s and 30s and hadn't grown up with the fierce repression of the early 50s when the pre, you know, their mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers had to face Russian tanks and soldiers who were going to kill them if they rebelled. Now it's become more sophisticated because the world was watching. East Germany needed vital loans from West Germany and America and everywhere else, Western banks, to keep afloat. I mean, that was a known thing that was happening, irrespective of what Russia was propping them up with. So they had to play ball, and they knew that if they were going to be a sovereign state that could go to the Olympic Games and could go to the World Cup and could sit at the UN, they had to abide by the rules. So the days of fierce repression, like you would see obviously in Tiananmen Square that year, where hundreds if not thousands were killed, they couldn't do that. So if their people were going to the borders with Hungary and Austria and Czechoslovakia and wanting to try and break through the barriers, there wasn't much they could do without there being serious, serious repercussions. And obviously by then Hungary was going to be lax in patrolling its borders. And there was your route. The East Germans could get into Hungary and then move straight into Austria and then find freedom. So it was very much a situation on the borders outside of Berlin that had played exactly like Berlin itself in 1961, where you've got masses of people who potentially could move across the border unmolested without the East German state doing anything. And because that was happening, and Gorbachev could see it was happening, and he made the famous speech to the East German Politburo in front of a shocked Honecker: if you don't move with events, you're going to be sunk. That's me just making his words up, but that's basically what he was saying. And Honecker just not accepting reality and saying, well, it's our 40th anniversary of the state being here, and another 40 years is definitely going to happen. The Berlin Wall's here to stay. And obviously he wasn't aware that the younger guard of the East German Politburo were listening to Gorbachev and removed him quite quickly before the wall came down. So all this was going on. So in one way, hindsight's a great thing. And again, as I said before, if you joined the dots, you might think they were going to do something terrible and build a massive barrier in 61. If you look at all the things that were going on and take all these separate events and join them together, you think, of course the East German state was going to fall. It was obvious because the Russians were going to pull the plug. And the vital thing was, as soon as there were mass demonstrations in Berlin and Dresden and Leipzig, where hundreds of thousands of protesters could advocate democracy and holding democratic elections, and the East German security state apparatus stood back and allowed them to do it, the writing was on the wall. And Gorbachev had to make the decision: if push comes to shove and the Berlin Wall does fall and the East German state falls, what do we do? What do I do with the 300,000 or more Soviet soldiers I have stationed in East Germany, throughout East Germany? What do I do with the 3,000 tanks that are stationed throughout East Germany? Do I say to them, get out there and support the East German, the hardliners in the East German state? Or do I say, stay in your barracks, do nothing, this isn't our fight, events will play out the way they're supposed to. I have bigger considerations to hold the Russian state together, to hold the Soviet Union together. That's my focus. Whatever happens in East Germany will happen in East Germany. It's a price worth paying for me saving my own country. And that's exactly what happened. And I think hindsight shows us that. But at the time, in real time, which is what I wanted to try and portray in the book, what I was trying to capture was, just like the wall going up, instead of the terror and anger and frustration and heartbreak of watching a wall being built, what I wanted to capture to bookend the narrative was to capture the excitement, the shock, the exhilaration, the joy and the tears of happiness as the wall came down, as the gates were opened, the checkpoints were opened through people power, and where a bullet wasn't fired, where no one was hurt, no one was killed, as this happened, and the world could watch And it's and one thing I would say, just to sorry carry on about this, was it was amazing for me to be in a cafe or someone's apartment in Berlin and be interviewing across the table many East Berliners and West Germans who now live in Berlin, but had family in East Berlin and East Germany. And I would be having great conversations with them, and they're just ordinary people like you and I, and they're just talking away, and they'd laugh, and they'd show indignation and anger when they were remembering or telling me anecdotes of whatever their specific experiences were through the life of the Berlin Wall. But on every occasion, when I spoke to them about that particular night and the subsequent few days after the checkpoints opening and the wall falling, all of them burst into tears, all of them. And I'd have to stop the tape and let them, you know, compose themselves. And some of them, you'd even give them a hug. And it was just amazing. And that gets back to my point about oral history and trying to capture that essence and that spark that makes that kind of narrative shine above everything else. It's just not dry history. It's capturing the moment and really, really getting to the core of the story by the people that actually experienced it.
And I like as well how you capture moments that we have sometimes glossed over with hindsight, as you point out in the book, that while for many people it's this triumphal moment of exaltation, of joyous release, you also illustrate how for some of like the border guards and the Soviet soldiers, there was a very real prospect that it could have turned out very differently, and how we've tended to lose that but for their recollections of their experiences of that moment.
Well, I think you were alluding to that with Robert Corbett. I mean, that's just an amazing story that not many people know about. It certainly hasn't been written about. And I think that's one of the key things in the book, actually, is that he stopped, and he did. I mean, he's very humble, but he did. And other people that I've spoken to afterwards have worked with him say the same thing. I mean, he stopped a mini Tiananmen Square happening at the Brandenburg Gate, because your listeners might not know this, but through just a weird geographic logistic accident, where the borders buffered up against each other for the British and the Soviet sector in Berlin, where you've got the Brandenburg Gate, past the Brandenburg Gate in the Tiergarten, you have the Soviet War Memorial. And that's a huge edifice that's built. They built it out of the rubble from the Reichstag, I might add. And it's an amazing, it's a very typical communist monument. It's huge and it's vulgar, but it takes the breath away in its size, and it represents the 80,000 Russian soldiers that died capturing Berlin in 1945. So to the Russians, it's sacrosanct, it's holy ground. And because that site was inside the British sector, an agreement was reached after the war was put up that the Soviets would always be allowed to have an honor guard guarding the memorial, and they had their own compound and a mini barracks, and they were always allowed to travel through the British checkpoint there to relieve the guard, obviously every day. And then when you have a Russian Memorial Day, they were allowed to do a big parade there and everything else. So on the night of the wall coming down, if you put yourselves in the shoes of the 40 or so Russian soldiers that were on guard at the memorial, and as we just said, everyone thinks the Berlin Wall is immovable. It's like the Himalayas. It's never coming down. And if you're just a conscript, a Russian conscript, and you're seeing people coming through the wall, people getting on the wall, West Germans surrounding your memorial, shouting at you, abusing you, probably wanting to get into the place, and you have no idea what's going to happen. Am I going to be strung up by the lamppost? Is that what's going to happen? Is it going to be like I saw on Tiananmen Square, where they're going to attack the soldiers because they think we're the enemy? And that's the situation Robert Corbett, as he was radioed to get over there to go and sort this out, faced when he arrived. You've got very scared, very panicked soldiers with their rifles locked and loaded and ready to resist. And he managed to talk these guys down. He sat in the middle of them, got them to stand all around him, and through an interpreter said, "I can't guarantee what happens in other sectors this evening with these momentous events that are going on. And I'm just as surprised as you are. This is all happening, but we've got to deal with it. All I can guarantee as the commander of the British section, no harm's going to come to you." And he said, as soon as this was translated in Russian to these soldiers, especially to their officers, their commanding officers, he could see their shoulders visibly relax. And they all thanked him, hugged him, gave him a guard of honor as he left. And then the amazing thing that happened afterwards was Robert's then driving to the next situation he has to resolve and find out what's going on. And he gets a call from the head of military intelligence in Berlin, said, "Can you come over quickly to the barracks?" And he does. And he says something incredible's happened. Because obviously this is well before we've got the internet and the kind of mobile phones we've got where we could easily swap information. He's just got a huge mobile phone in his Jeep. So he goes to the barracks and they say, "We've got this communique that's come through a channel." It was a communication channel the British had with the KGB and the head of the Soviet military. But Stalin closed it after the Berlin airlift and it was never opened again. That night they reopened it and the head of Soviet forces in Eastern Europe name-checked Robert and thanked him personally and said, "We will never forget what you've done for us tonight." And as I say in the epilogue, since that day happened, every year on Russian Soviet Memorial Day, he gets these amazing presents in the post, whether it's very expensive vodka, very expensive caviar, very expensive Soviet memorabilia, and they haven't forgotten. And so that's just one story. And then there's other stories of civilians just being in the right place at the right time and being near a checkpoint, and all of a sudden they're watching TV and they're like me at my university back in Britain. They're just seeing people coming through the checkpoints, their mouths drop open, they get their clothes on because obviously it's freezing cold that night, they rush out and start to party. And a lovely anecdote for your listeners in the US is the American policeman, Sergeant Michael Rafferty, who goes to bed, having finished a shift with his family, thinking, right, I'm back on shift at 6 o'clock in the morning, goes to bed thinking, you know, the Berlin Wall, you know, he's just done his job and it's still there and it's impregnable. Wakes up and he's driving along back down to the he's driving back down in his Jeep, being overtaken by his friends with the alarms going off. And he's thinking, oh, my God, what's happening? He's briefed by one of his friends who jumps in the Jeep with him. And then he's on the most surreal tour of duty for the next 12 hours, where he's just seeing this historic scene of hundreds of East German Trabant diesel cars driving through his little checkpoint, thousands of East Germans hugging and kissing him, giving him drinks, asking him directions of where to go, and him choking on the diesel fumes. It was just fantastic. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is capture the big moments from the big people who played big parts, such ex-Secretary of State James A. Baker's in there as well, talking about what it was like in the White House. But more importantly, I'm trying to capture what the ordinary person was feeling, whether they're military policemen on the borders or whether they're just civilians who, like I said, were caught in the right place at the right time and just see an absolutely iconic moment of history happen before their eyes.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm just doing preliminary investigations. It is a kind of part of the Cold War, but it happened during the Cold War. But it's more of a French thing. I've always been fascinated by the various assassination attempts on President de Gaulle. So at the moment, I'm just talking to some key figures that were involved in either political groups that were against what he did in the French moving out of Algeria and the resistance that happened through people, especially in the armed forces that were there, really hating him for it, and obviously doing their best to try and kill him in revenge. So it's just fascinating. And obviously there's been a few films in the past, The Day of the Jackal, for instance. And I just find that part of history I find fascinating. And I've found quite a few people who have never had their story told before. So I'm hoping to tell a more kind of espionage thriller type narrative about that part of important European and world history.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be quite a great book if the research pans out and if it gets published. I hope we can have you back on the New Books Network.
Yeah, that would be great. It's like this book. It's all in the telling, isn't it? If you can find the right people, you can tell a brilliant narrative. I'm only as good as the people I interview. Simple as that.
Well, I think you're being a little too modest, because you definitely do a great job telling their stories.
Well, that's nice of you to say so. Thank you.
Well, Ian McGregor, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.